came to see me, not while Mum was alive. And then I was sent to St. Mary's.
So you would have no idea where he is now, said Watson. Holmes, I don't know what you're doing bringing a woman and a child to a murder scene, said the red-haired man. Watson can make himself useful, although nowadays he seems to spend his time recording your exploits rather than examining bodies. But they have no business being here.
I'm not a child, said Diana. And who do you think you are, Carrots?
Carrots yourself, said the red-haired man, glaring at her. This is Inspector Lestrade of Scotland Yard, said Holmes. He's not in the habit of locking up young women for rudeness, but it's probably a good idea not to tempt him. Lestrade, this is Miss Jekyll, the daughter of Dr. Jekyll, who was involved in the Carew murder case. You may remember it, although it was many years ago. She's here on business, with me. But I'm afraid, Miss Jekyll, that this murder takes precedence. It was reported an hour ago. A man who does odd jobs in these parts found the body of a woman named Molly Keane lying in this alley. I have not yet examined the body myself and must do so at some length. As you are here, you and Miss Hyde may stay, but you may wish to avert your eyes. It's not a sight for the squeamish, I'm afraid.
Mary stood undecided, afraid to see what lay under the sheet. Her head isn't missing, is it? She asked.
That was the last victim, said Lestrade. He never takes the same body part twice, and if you look carefully you'll see the outline of her head, or most of it. But, Holmes, I protest, this is highly irregular.
Holmes paid no attention but lifted the sheet and handed it to one of the sergeants, who folded it gingerly, trying not to get blood on his uniform. Mary gasped.
Horrible, said Watson.
Lord, he done her in good, said Diana.
Molly Keane had been around Mary's age. She must have been a pretty girl. The bones of her face were strong and fine, although the face itself was bruised. There were blue marks over the cheeks and under the eyes. Those eyes looked up at the grey sky, lifeless. There was blood spattered over her shoulders and soaked into her dress. Since the pavement was still wet from the morning's rains, the paving stones around her were slick and red, with blood pooling in the spaces between them. Her long hair trailed in the blood on the pavement. Mary forced herself to look back up to what she had been avoiding. The head, lying in a pool of blood. The entire top of it above the eyebrows was gone.
He cut out her brain, said Holmes.
What could he possibly want with it? Asked Mary.
He must be a madman, said Lestrade. Who else would do something like that? Molly Keane was a... Well, I'm not going to say anything in front of the ladies. You shouldn't even be here, neither of you.
Aho, said Diana. We know. Look at the rouge on her cheeks.
But not an ordinary one, said Holmes. Look at her hands. Her palms are not calloused by manual labour, and her clothes are of good quality, although patched and mended. However she may have fallen, she was once a lady.
You're right about that, said Lestrade. While we were waiting for you, Sergeant Debenham talked to one of the other girls who works this area. He's got her waiting at an inn around the corner. He's also holding the man who found the body, a local beggar who goes by Poor Richard and hasn't any other name, so far as I can tell. You'll want to talk to them, Holmes. According to her friend, Molly Keane had been a governess until she was seduced by her master and thrown out by her mistress. Her child died at birth, and she went on the streets to earn her living.
A sad story,
and not an uncommon one, said Watson, shaking his head. Poor girl, said Mary. She had read about this side of London life, but never encountered it herself. It shocked her, although not perhaps as much as it should have. This was life, wasn't it? Life as she had often imagined it, looking out the curtained windows of the house on Park Terrace.
or stupid, said Diana. I've lived with whores all my life, whether they were working or reformed. Whores know all sorts of ways to avoid getting with child. They can make customers withdraw, or use a sheepskin, or...
Diana, said Mary.
Diana.
How is that more shocking than getting with child, I'd like to know?
Mary. One doesn't talk about such things, particularly in front of gentlemen.
Diana.
Then one is as stupid as Molly Keane.
She may have fallen into sin, said Holmes, but she died bravely. Look at her right hand. The fingernails are broken, and there is flesh under them. She fought for her life, poor girl.
What's that in her left hand? Asked Mary.
Before Mary could stop her, Diana crouched by the body of Molly Keane, getting blood on the hem of her dress and the toes of her boots. She reached across the murdered girl to the stiff hand that lay on her bosom and pried open the clenched fingers. From that cold grasp, she withdrew what the girl had been holding, a metal button.
Diana! Cried Mary.
Bloody hell! Said Lestrade,
sputtering as though he did not know how to go on.
Don't you know never to touch a murder victim? Holmes, I'm holding you responsible.
All right, I'm responsible, said Holmes. You should not have done that, Miss Hyde. There might have been fingerprints, although it's unlikely we would find any but Molly Keane's. But since you have... What is it?
It's a button of some sort. No, I think it's a watch fob, said Mary, taking it from Diana in her handkerchief so as not to touch it and examining it closely. It was made of brass and heavy in her hand. Part of the chain is still attached, and there's something...
The fob was caked with blood, but she could make out letters on the bottom, engraved into the metal.
S.A. It could be a set of initials, or it could stand for something, some sort of motto.
Indeed, said Holmes. I've seen fobs like this worn by members of scientific societies, or social clubs, or even cricket teams. They're often used as seals, which would explain the engraving. She must have torn it from the murderer during their struggle. Miss Jekyll, if you could step aside, I would like to examine the body thoroughly, and take your ward with you, if you please.
Mary grabbed Diana by the arm and pulled her back, out of the way. Holmes walked around and around the body while the rest of them stood and watched. It was almost comical to see him, bent over like a praying mantis, inspecting the ground around the murdered girl, lifting her hands, turning her head from side to side, and looking at her bruises. Finally, he examined the hole in her head. Mary had to turn away, sickened by the sight. Then he made a careful examination of the alley. He seemed to be looking at every stone, from the cross street at one end to the blank wall at the other. It was, Mary thought, a good place to commit a murder. The alley was long and narrow. Neither of the buildings that formed its walls had windows overlooking the alley, so the solid brick rose sheer. Close to the street, the building on one side had been built out so that it hung over the alley, blocking some of the light. Toward its blind end, there was a large doorway. It looked like the back entrance to a warehouse, but the door was evidently locked on the inside, since Holmes turned the handle and rattled it several times. Last night there would have been no one to see, and no way out for poor Molly Keane. Holmes paid particular attention to that doorway, returning to it once he had examined the rest of the alley.
"How long is he going to take?"
Lestrade finally asked, looking at his watch.
"I have poor Richard and that other girl waiting, and I want to question them before they start getting restless."
"As long as it takes," said Watson. "You know him well enough to know his methods."
As far as Mary could tell, it took forever. She did not know how much longer she could keep Diana quiet. Her furious whispers that Lestrade would lock Diana up in Newgate in the deepest, darkest cell where rats would chew her ears off, were losing their effect. But finally Holmes rejoined them.
Well, said Lestrade. They were careful, said Holmes. They? We assumed this was the work of an individual madman.
Unconsciously, Lestrade chewed on a corner of his moustache. Mary almost laughed, but reminded herself that this was no laughing matter.
No, there were two of them, and I wish you had called me in on this case earlier. If I'd been able to examine where the other victims were found, I might have been able to tell you more. It's obvious that they had to leave the murder scene quickly, or they would have attempted to hide the body as they did in the cases of Sally Hayward and Anna Pettingill. But the rain early this morning has wiped away most of their traces. There are few clues on the site. Watson, when would you say she was killed?
By the general condition of the body, I would say late last night or early this morning.
I agree. They obviously did not want to take the chance of being detected, so they chose the cover of darkness to commit their crime. I would put it closer to early morning, before the rain began. Her clothes are still damp.
How can you tell there were two of them? Said Lestrade,
which was, of course, what Mary had been wondering.
One left two footprints in the mud under that overhang where the rain has not erased them.
He gestured toward the overhang at the entrance to the alley. They had walked under it themselves when they arrived.
By the distance between them, I would put him at not much above 5 feet. By the distance his boots sank into the mud, he is not a heavy man. 8 or 9 stone. And they are undoubtedly the boots of a gentleman.
A gentleman, said Watson. What gentleman would do such a deed?
Oh, please, said Diana. The things I've seen gentlemen do.
And the other man? Asked Mary.
He has left no traces, said Holmes. But Molly Keane's neck is broken, and I don't think the man we've been describing would have the strength to break her neck. He's small and light, and lame in one leg.
Lame? Said Lestrade. How is that, Holmes?
His footprints in the mud. One of them is straight, the other bent, almost as though he had a club foot, although without deformity. To look at, he must be a twisted man. I don't think he has the strength to saw into a woman's head. You're looking for a surgical saw, I think, Lestrade. Yes, and a sharp knife to remove her brain with, perhaps a scalpel. This was a more delicate operation than Pauline Delacroix, whose entire head was missing. Two men are most definitely indicated. One strong enough to break a woman's neck and saw through her skull, another with the knowledge and skill to take out her brain. You may be looking for a medical man, or a man with medical training.
The devil, said Watson.
Indeed, said Holmes. Unfortunately, I was able to get nothing more. The rain has washed too much away. I would like to talk with the girl who identified Molly Keane, and with this poor Richard. You say they are at a nearby inn?
I would like to come with you, Mr. Holmes, said Mary.
That's entirely out of the question, said Lestrade. This is a police investigation, young lady. You don't belong here in the first place.
Holmes looked at her curiously.
Why is that, Miss Jekyll?
Your description. It reminds me of something, someone.
Indeed. Lestrade, I would like you to indulge me this once.
Miss Jekyll, if you can keep Miss Hyde under control, you may listen in on my interviews, but only so long as she behaves herself, mind.
Indulge you this once, said Lestrade, considering how often I give in to your notions.
But Holmes was already walking up the alley, and Lestrade had to hurry after, shouting directions to his sergeants about how they were to transport the body of Molly Keane back to Scotland Yard. Watson followed, and Mary dragged Diana behind her by the wrist. The inn was just around the corner, It was called The Bells, and had a sign with faded yellow bells painted on it above the front door. The police had cleared out the pub that formed its first floor, so inside there were no patrons, only the landlord behind the bar, disgruntled because he was losing custom. A policeman looking uncomfortable and bored, a young woman rather splendidly but cheaply dressed, and a man with a grizzled beard, who must have been poor Richard. He seemed to be wearing a collection of rags. Mrs. Poole.
A pub. To think that Miss Mary should have entered such a place.
Mary. Mrs. Poole. There were no patrons inside, and there were policemen, and Mr. Holmes, and Dr. Watson. I don't know how it could have been more respectable.
Mrs. Poole. Nothing about a murder investigation is respectable.
Let's have the man who found her first, said Holmes.
Lestrade brought poor Richard over to a corner of the pub where Holmes had gathered several chairs around a table. One for himself, one for Lestrade, one for the person they were questioning. Mary found herself another chair and sat discreetly behind Holmes, where she could see poor Richard's face as he was interrogated. Diana perched on the edge of a stool, and Watson leaned against the wall. Mary sent up a silent prayer.
For goodness sake, just let Diana stay quiet.
She wanted to hear what poor Richard had to say.
Beatrice, how did you manage to keep Diana quiet all that time?
Diana.
I can be quiet when I want to. I wanted to hear what they were talking about, too.
Now then, said Holmes, when poor Richard was sitting across from him. How did you find the body of this girl, Molly Keane?
Well, it was like this, sir. I wandered into the alley to have a smoke and just stumbled across her like,
he said in a thin, high voice. It was not the voice Mary had expected, coming out of what was still a large man, under all his rags.
Then I told Jim here.
He gestured back toward the landlord behind the bar, who nodded.
And he called the constable on duty. That's all I know, sir.
He stared at Holmes with bloodshot eyes, and Mary noticed that his hands on the table were trembling.
That won't do, you know, said Holmes, smiling at him, not unkindly. I want the truth from you. No more, no less. The sleeve of your coat is stained with blood. If you don't tell me how you discovered Molly Keane, I shall have Sergeant Debenham arrest you on suspicion of her murder.
To Mary's astonishment, poor Richard put his head in his hands and began to sob. And yes, there, she could see it. The cuff of his coat, a faded tweed that had seen better days, was streaked with red. She must become more observant, like Mr. Holmes. When she had first met him, shooting so theatrically at the wall, she had dismissed him as a charlatan. But now that she was seeing him in action, she had to admire his powers of observation and deduction. If only she could develop such abilities in herself.
Diana. You'd better not let him see this chapter. I don't know what his nosiness would think of being called a charlatan. He's so used to being worshipped by Dr. Watson and anyone who reads The Strand.
Mary. He knows perfectly well what I thought of him at first. And he knows my opinions changed since then.
None of that, said Lestrade. You'll answer the question, or it's off to jail with you. It's all right, said Holmes. Here, landlord, bring this man a pint of your best ale, on me. Shall I tell you what you did last night? You can tell me whether I'm right or not.
Poor Richard raised his head and nodded. The prospect of ale seemed to have restored his spirits.
You had been drinking, as you often do. One can't mistake the red nose of the habitual drunkard. You knew there was a doorway at the back of the alley, and that it was sufficiently hidden so you could sleep there without being told to move on. Perhaps you had slept there before. I suspect it's one of your regular spots. So you stumbled into the alley and fell asleep.
You were still asleep when two men brought Molly Keane into the alley and murdered her. But I think they must have woken you enough that you stirred or made some noise. I conjecture that's what sent them running from the alley. They had not thought anyone would be there. Do you remember seeing or hearing them?
You're right enough, said poor Richard. I fell asleep in that doorway, although how you know it, I have no idea.
You were telling the truth when you said that you had a smoke, replied Holmes. You sat in that doorway smoking before you fell asleep. I found your match where you tossed it, and you dropped ashes in the doorway where they would not be washed away by the rain. There are identical ashes on the front of your coat and that scarf around your neck. The ash from pipe tobacco is easily distinguished from the ash of a cigar or cigarette, and I note the general shape of a pipe in your breast pocket. A man does not sit and smoke his pipe in a dark alley, but he might well do so at sunset as he prepares for sleep. It was obvious that you had entered the alley while it was still light, then fallen asleep in the doorway. Several threads from your coat were caught on a splinter in the door. I deduced a man in a tweed coat who was a pipe smoker, and here you are. That you slept in the doorway without waking is evident from your trousers, which are still damp from the knees down. The doorway was a large one, but you're a tall man, and your legs stuck out at an angle into the rain. Not even being cold and wet could wake you, intoxicated as you were.
Well, I don't remember waking, said poor Richard. If I'd seen a woman being murdered, I would never have spent the night there. It gives me the shivers just thinking about it. Her body lying there in the darkness while I slept. Do you think she'll haunt me, sir?
But you must have touched her, said Mary. I've been wondering how you could have gotten blood on your cuff, and that's the only way.
Is that true? Said Lestrade. If I find that you've taken anything from the murder victim...
Oh, pity an old man, said poor Richard,
rapidly searching through his coat pockets and bringing out a dirty handkerchief.
Here, this is all I took.
He shook the handkerchief, and out fell a sovereign, shiny except where blood crusted the edges.
I found it lying beside her on the ground. It must have fallen out of her hand or her pocket, but that's all, I swear. I had nothing to do with her murder.
He wiped his eyes and blew his nose loudly.
Well done, Miss Jekyll, said Holmes. Molly Keane was paid handsomely, no doubt to entice her to her death. I believe we've gotten as much as we can out of you, my man. Consider yourself free to go. Unless Lestrade wants a beggar taking up space in his prison, I see no reason to detain you.
Lestrade was not interested in holding poor Richard. After the old man had stumbled out of the pub, he said,
I can't see that half-wit removing a woman's brain. He's well known in this area, and the local constable will keep an eye on him. He may know more about this murder than he's letting on, but if those men were his confederates, I want him out of prison so he can lead us to them. He's more used to us out of prison than in.
The girl was a different proposition than old Richard.
Call me Kate, she said. That's what I'm known by, and I won't be telling you my last name if it's all the same to you, sir. Kate Brighteyes is what they call me around here, and that's good enough for you, I reckon. The less you tell the police, the better, I find. But I'll tell you about poor Molly. She may have been on the streets, but she didn't deserve to be treated like that.
Indeed, said Holmes. And what can you tell us about her?
Kate was pretty beneath her paint, although if you looked closely you could tell she was no longer as young as she seemed, and there were pockmarks on her cheek. She was slender, with bright eyes, rather like an inquisitive bird. Mary looked at her with interest. So this was what a fallen woman looked like. Exactly like any other woman, except for her fancier dress and general air of boldness. In another life, Kate could have been a parlourmaid, like Enid.
Well, Molly was a good girl, a governess until her master took liberties. No, I don't know where, she wouldn't say, nor where her family was. After the child died, she worked the streets, and made a fair bit, too. The gentleman liked her educated ways. She tried to reform for a while, went to one of them reform societies, but it only lasted a week. Couldn't stand the sanctimonious piety, she said. No, she didn't say where. Somewhere in Whitechapel or Spitalfields, I believe. She wasn't one to talk much, was Molly. Last night she was just as usual. The night was getting on, and it was so cold and damp that there had been no custom, so we sat by the fire in the bells. Then Molly says, I think I'll be getting on home, Kate. I told her I would finish my beer. Molly was so ladylike, she never drank anything but barley water. So she puts on her coat, and out she goes. And then I thought, I'm almost done anyway. I'll drink up quickly so we can walk home together, companionable. My place wasn't much farther than hers, and we'd been talking about sharing a flat, not liking our situations at present. But when I got outside, I saw that she'd found a customer after all. He was talking to her. There was just enough light coming through the window to see by. You want to know how he looked? I only caught a glimpse in passing, but he was a small gentleman, twisted-like. Reminded me of Punch in the Punch and Judy. He had a strange whispering voice, as though he didn't want to be heard. I didn't rightly hear what he said, and you may think I'm making this up, but that voice chilled my spine, like ice. I walked past them without a word to Molly and went home. I didn't want her to lose the custom, see? But now I wish I'd said good night. And that's the last time I saw her until this sergeant asked me to look at her, lying in the alley. What he did to her. I hope you catch him and string him up good. Kate looked down at her hands on the table, but did not cry. What good would it have done? We often think that class of woman is hard-hearted because it does not show emotion. But what good would it do for the Kates of the world to cry? They have learned that tears do not bring relief or change of circumstance. There is no one to wipe their tears, no one to assuage their grief. Mary. Oh, for goodness sake. She got what was much more useful. After thanking her, Mr. Holmes gave her the sovereign. What in the world would she have done with someone to wipe her tears? Kate's not as sentimental as you are. Justine. We all need human sympathy. Diana. I don't. Before getting up, Kate said, You remind me of someone, Ducky. Mary was startled to realize that she was looking directly at Diana, who was turning back and forth on her stool. Are you in the trade? You look young to be in it. But there are plenty of young ones, more's the pity. Diana looked back at her defiantly. My mother was known as Gilded Lily at Mrs. Barstow's. Ah, oh, that's it, then. I knew her when I was a young one myself, although I wasn't at Mrs. Barstow's for long. I fell on hard times. Don't let them tell you that laudanum's harmless because it ain't. And by the time I was right again, the establishment had closed. She was spirited, your mum, and kind to us younger girls. I hope you're not in trouble with these legal gentlemen. When Diana shook her head, she said, Well, if you ever are, remember Kate Brighteyes at the Bells. Any friend of your mum's will be a friend of yours, and don't you forget it.
I think we've done all we can here, said Holmes, after handing her the sovereign and thanking her for the information she had provided. It's long past time for tea. Watson is used to my habits. I often eat irregularly when I'm on a case, but the two of you must be hungry.
Just then Diana's stomach gave a low growl.
Watson can take you back to Regent's Park. I must go with Lestrade. We have a great deal to talk about.
But Mr. Holmes, said Mary, this man, this twisted gentleman with the low voice who looks like Punch, that's a description of Mr. Hyde. I thought of him immediately after we saw Molly Keane's body. Remember that he was my father's assistant. He has surgical knowledge.
Holmes smiled. That's an interesting connection, Miss Jekyll.
and one I had considered myself, which is why I allowed you to stay and participate in this investigation. But rather tenuous, don't you think? There must be many small, twisted men in London who could wield a scalpel, and Hyde has not been seen since the Carew murder. Beware the idée fixe. You've been thinking of Hyde, so he seems an obvious suspect. But he also presents significant problems. We don't even know if he's still alive.
"Who is this Hyde?" asked Lestrade. "Should I add him to the list of suspects?"
"I'm surprised you don't remember," said Holmes. "He was involved in the case I mentioned. The murder of Sir Danvers Carew, the Liberal MP who was at one point spoken of as a possible Prime Minister. Hyde was identified by a reliable witness as the murderer, but when the police went to arrest him, he had disappeared. He has not been heard of since, although Miss Jekyll briefly thought she was on his track."
"Well, of course, it was years ago," said Lestrade, looking put out. "I'll have to go through the records again."
"And you think this Hyde may be in London murdering prostitutes?"
"It seems unlikely," said Holmes.
"Although I never discount the improbable until it has been proven impossible."
"I thought the previous victims were maids and shop girls," said Mary. "Wasn't that what the newspaper boys had been crying for the last few days?"
"Oh, that's the line we've been giving the newspapers, but they're what you might call ladies of the evening right enough. I don't think we can hold back that knowledge much longer. Imagine how much larger the headlines will be with a sex angle thrown in. And then the newspapers will start on why the London police haven't solved these murders. Incompetence of the police. That's how it always goes."
Lestrade pulled on his moustache and looked bitter.
"You think my father's been going around murdering prostitutes?" said Diana.
She broke into a peal of laughter.
"Now watch yourself, miss," said Lestrade. "I don't like young ladies getting hysterics. Clearly Miss Hyde has some information she would like to share with us," said Holmes.
Diana laughed again.
"Jekyll's dead, according to Miss Mary here. That means Hyde's dead. My mum told me that Hyde was just another name for Jekyll. Hyde was a disguise Jekyll used when he didn't want to be found out. Like a cloak."
"That's not possible," said Mary. "I met Hyde when my father was still alive. My housekeeper, Mrs. Poole, remembers him. He looked nothing like my father."
"Are you calling my mother a liar?" asked Diana, scowling.
"I think we must rely on Miss Jekyll's evidence in this case," said Holmes. "Your mother may have been deceived. Hyde may have told her that he was Jekyll in order to act the part of a gentleman, perhaps even to use Jekyll's credit."
There was a look on Diana's face, anger at not being believed, and something that startled Mary, a grimace as though she were about to cry. Diana.
"Oh, bosh!"
Mary.
"No, that's exactly what I remember."
"My father had many secrets," said Mary. "I don't know what sort of relationship he had with Mr. Hyde. Of course, what Diana suggests is impossible."
"I'm sorry," she said, turning to Diana. "But one man can't simply disguise himself as another, not when their appearances are so different. Hyde was at least a foot shorter than my father. However, there must be something more to their relationship than we are aware of, or why would my mother support his child? I know my supposition is far-fetched, Mr. Holmes, but the description fits Hyde perfectly. I still remember that low voice and the chill it sent down my spine. Like ice, as Kate Brighteyes said."
"If there's a possibility that Hyde is still out there, I want to know about it," said Lestrade. "We don't want murderers walking the streets of London, and there's Carew to pay for. But he's likely long gone, to Australia or South America."
"You're almost certainly right," said Holmes. "Nevertheless, I would like Miss Jekyll to examine her father's papers again. Could you do that, Miss Jekyll, and report back to me tomorrow?"
"Of course," said Mary. She wanted to read through the notebook again in particular, systematically this time. There had been some mention of Hyde, but she could not remember in what context. And what in the world was she going to do with Diana?
"Watson, can you take these ladies home? I'll meet you back at Baker Street after I've talked with Lestrade."
Holmes looked from one of them to the other. It was difficult to tell what he was thinking, but Mary thought he seemed, well, almost amused. "Come on," said Mary to Diana. She was not interested in amusing Mr. Holmes. She was grateful to him for having included her in the investigation, but also irritated. She was not sure why. "I have a lot of work to do, and you need a bath."
"No, I don't," said Diana.
"Bath or you won't get dinner." Mary grabbed Diana by a dirty wrist and pulled her along. Watson walked beside them, trying not to smile, as Diana glared and muttered under her breath. Mary resolutely ignored her. She would ask Mrs. Poole to make a strong pot of tea, and she would stay up all night if she had to. What secrets did those papers hold? What had she missed the first time? She did not know, but she wanted to find out. Chapter 5. The Letter from Italy. Climbing down from the cab, Mary found it difficult to believe that she had just come from Whitechapel, that such a place even existed. Park Terrace was broad and quiet, and the only sound was the clopping of the horse's hooves as it stepped impatiently in place. The brick buildings, dating from the time of one of the Georges, she could never remember which, stood along the street in respectable rows. Over the roofs and chimney pots of the row opposite from the Jekyll residence, she could see the tops of the trees in Regent's Park.
"Well, isn't this swell?" said Diana.
And there, of course, was the evidence that Mary had indeed spent a morning in the dregs of the city, the dirty, ragged girl beside her. What in the world was she going to do with Diana? The door opened.
"Come in, come in," said Mrs. Poole. "You'll catch your chill standing out there on the pavement."
Mary turned and thanked Watson, who had handed her and Diana down the steps of the cab.
"Think nothing of it, Miss Jekyll," he said.
He had already paid the cabby, once again insisting that it was a business expense, which worried Mary. Kind as he was, she disliked feeling a sense of obligation, but there was nothing to be done about that now.
"Although, of course, it was a pleasure as well," he added. "Having a young lady of keen intellect such as yours, shall we say, involved in Holmes's investigation makes a refreshing change. I shall see you tomorrow. At noon? Should Holmes and I meet you here?"
"Thank you," said Mary, not quite knowing what to make of the compliment, but certain it was not the one he had originally intended to make. "I think it would be best if we came to Baker Street. At noon, then, Dr. Watson." She did not want Holmes, or Watson, of course, to see the bare walls, the uncarpeted floors, the places where there had once been vases filled with flowers, or plaster busts of philosophers. It was pride, and pride was a sin. But still...
"Ta," said Diana. "Until tomorrow, then."
Watson bowed, unsuccessfully hiding a smile, and said,
"Ta to you as well, Miss Hyde."
Then he strode off toward Marylebone Road. "Come on," Mary said to Diana, who was examining the house and Mrs. Poole. "If you keep staring like that, your eyes will fall out." Diana gave her what Mary would come to call that look of mingled contempt and annoyance, but she followed Mary up the steps and into the front hall.
Mary: "She gives me that look all the time."
Diana:
"I wouldn't if you weren't so annoying."
Diana's trunk was waiting in the hall. Yet another thing for which they were obliged to Dr. Watson.
"This came for you earlier today," said the housekeeper. "It was delivered on a vegetable cart, but the man said Miss Jekyll right enough, so I told him to leave it by the staircase."
"Yes, thank you, Mrs. Poole," said Mary, as the housekeeper took her umbrella. "I had it sent. I'm sorry. I should have sent a note, but we were in a bit of a hurry."
She put the portfolio with the papers in it on the hall table, then pulled off her mackintosh and handed that to Mrs. Poole as well.
How tired she was!
She had not realized it until now, but it had been a long day, and as Holmes had pointed out, she had not eaten since breakfast.
"Do we have a guest, miss?" asked Mrs. Poole, looking doubtfully at Diana with her bare legs and hatless head. She checked the mackintosh for stains before folding it neatly over her arm.
"This is Diana," said Mary, "and she needs a bath."
"I don't want to take a bath," said Diana.
"Yes, you do," said Mary. "You don't actually like being that filthy. You just want to be contradictory. Mrs. Poole will draw you one. I assure you it will be better than anything you could get at St. Mary Magdalene. And then we will have tea, I think, if you wouldn't mind, Mrs. Poole."
Diana grinned.
"Oh, it's going to be a treat living with you. I can see that already. You're just like that detective. You tell people what to do and they do it simply because they're used to following orders. Well, I'm not."
"Obviously," said Mary. "Nevertheless, you are going to take a bath because you smell, and I don't want you sitting on the furniture in that state. No tea unless you take a bath first."
"Come on, you," said Mrs. Poole. "Miss Mary says into the bath, so into the bath you go. And while you're in this house, you will speak to her with respect. Miss Mary is a lady."
She took Diana by the arm and pulled her toward the stairs.
"And what am I? A piece of dirt?" said Diana.
"Near enough," responded Mrs. Poole. When they were gone, Mary took off her hat and gloves, leaving them on the hall table. She glanced at herself in the mirror. She was still pale, but the fresh air had put some colour into her cheeks. She looked more alive than she had before her visit to Mr. Guest. She took the portfolio into the parlour. Should she turn on the gas? It was getting dark, but she didn't want to use it until absolutely necessary. She lit the fire, which was once again already laid. Thank goodness for Mrs. Poole. The housekeeper should find other employment, but Mary did not know what she would do without her. How lonely it would be. She sat on the sofa with the portfolio next to her, warming her hands and staring into the flames. It had been horrible, that poor girl. But she could not help being interested in the case. It was a mystery, and surely everyone was interested in mysteries, in untangling their various threads. One of the threads was sitting next to her on the sofa. Once again she pulled the tea table in front of her, set the portfolio on it, and began pulling out its contents, the account book, the laboratory notebook, the letters and receipts. They were all she had left of her father, the only clues to the mystery of his life and death. She put them into neat piles. She had looked at them last night, but had been focused on the book of accounts, and the possibility that Hyde was still alive. She would go through them more carefully now. Diana's claim couldn't possibly be true. But why had her father hired Hyde? So unpleasant, so unreliable, and as it turned out, a criminal. And why had her mother supported Diana all those years? She had not wanted to question Diana in front of Mr. Holmes and the police. This was a family matter, and she wanted to explore it privately. What had been the relationship between her father and Hyde, and her father's fortune? Was it a coincidence that it had disappeared at the same time as Hyde? Had it been a matter of blackmail? If so, for what? She remembered her mother after her father's death. So secretive, so unwilling to discuss her life with him even before the long descent into madness. Mary had assumed her reluctance was a result of grief, but maybe there was more to it. The documents. She would focus on them. Systematically, she began sorting through each pile, starting with those she had paid the least attention to last night. Letters first, taking each one out of its envelope. Two of them were from Moore and Sons, the Scientific Supply Company. The other three letters had foreign stamps. Two of them she set aside, but the third from Italy. She read it again more carefully this time. She looked through the receipts from Moore and Sons, and then she looked through the laboratory notebook, knowing what to search for, although she dreaded finding it. If only her father hadn't had such crabbed, eccentric handwriting. It was like trying to decipher the movements of a spider. The letter from Italy had given her a clue she would never have paid attention to last night. But tonight, a particular sentence in the letter had stood out, taken on a different and more sinister meaning. A scientist should not experiment on himself. What exactly had her father been doing? It could not mean, but she was starting to think it could. She looked at the letter again, then the notebook, then the receipts. She leaned back into the sofa, staring at the painting of her mother over the mantelpiece without seeing it, lost in thought. Surely what she imagined was impossible, and yet she could think of no other explanation.
"Here's your tea, miss."
She blinked, startled. It was Mrs. Poole with the tea tray.
"I don't know as you've eaten since breakfast, so I made some ham sandwiches and some paste as well. That will be the last of the ham for a while, I'm afraid. There should be enough for the both of you once that brat gets out of the bath, which may not be until Judgment Day. For all the screaming she did going in, now that she's in, she doesn't want to come out."
"Her name is Diana Hyde," said Mary. "She says she's Hyde's daughter. She's the one my mother was supporting in a sort of charitable institution."
"You don't say. Well, she does look rather like him, with that grin of hers, like an imp plotting mischief. And she's wicked enough for anything. Tried to bite my arm when I put her in the bathtub. Not that I'm going to put up with that sort of nonsense. I wonder who her mother could be. I pity her, whoever she was, getting herself involved with a man like Hyde. The ways of men are unaccountable, my mother always told me. Not that I've ever been married myself, thank the Lord. Where should I put these?"
"Oh, I'm sorry," said Mary. "Can you put them on the sideboard? I've made a bit of a mess on the table, I'm afraid. And would you mind pouring me a cup of tea, Mrs. Poole? I don't want to lose my place here." "She says more than that. She claims Hyde was not a man at all, but a sort of disguise my father wore to visit, well, places he should not have been, evidently. Hyde was a way to hide his activities."
"Surely not, miss," said Mrs. Poole, looking astonished. "Why, the two were quite different. Dr. Jekyll was a tall, distinguished-looking gentleman, and Mr. Hyde was a low, creeping sort of thing. It's not possible, I assure you."
"Did you ever see them together?" asked Mary.
That would settle the question once and for all. "Well, no, I can't say as I did," said Mrs. Poole, putting the tea tray on the sideboard. "But that doesn't prove anything, does it? Perhaps Mr. Hyde claimed to be his master. I wouldn't put it past him, especially when it came to the matter of paying bills."
Mrs. Poole handed Mary a cup of tea.
"Lemon and sugar, as usual. I took the liberty of putting in two, seeing as you need strength after such a long day."
Mary took a sip. Ah, that was better. Of course she should have eaten, but there simply hadn't been time with the visit to Mr. Holmes, and then to Whitechapel, and then the body of poor Molly Keane. "What do you remember about my father, Mrs. Poole?" she asked. "I was so young when he died, and he was not an affectionate father, even then. He was kind, or tried to be, but I always felt a little intimidated around him.
I remember him teaching me the table of elements and showing me how the flame of the Bunsen burner turned different colours in response to various chemicals.
Well, said Mrs. Poole, frowning. He was always a kind gentleman, as you say, even to a chambermaid as I was then. Although he smelled funny, it was those chemicals he used. Always experimenting, he was, in the laboratory. My father never believed he committed suicide. Thought he might have swallowed one of those chemicals of his by accident and poisoned himself.
He may have poisoned himself, in a way, said Mary. She hesitated. Would her idea sound foolish? Impossible? But she had to tell someone, and she had known Mrs. Poole as long as she could remember. Mrs. Poole had been like a mother to her, when her own mother couldn't be. These documents imply, they seem to indicate, that he was performing chemical experiments on himself, and one of those experiments transformed him into Hyde. The disguise wasn't just a physical change, like changing his clothes and putting on false hair, but an actual chemical transformation.
Lord have mercy, said Mrs. Poole. Is that even possible?
I know it sounds absurd, said Mary, but look at this. She opened the laboratory notebook to a page she had marked and pointed to an entry written in her father's crabbed, shaky script.
Today, I let out the beast, Hyde. He is stronger than I am. What will he do when I can no longer control his impulses?
Last night she had assumed these sentences meant her father had fought with Hyde. Now they took on a different meaning. And look, a couple of pages later. Mary flipped past several pages of formulas and scientific notes.
The sight of my face in the mirror. The horror. The horror. He has gained the power to transform at will, and I cannot stop him.
And the final entry.
All is lost. All lost. And I am a dead man.
I don't understand, said Mrs. Poole.
How could she explain? It would sound so strange, almost absurd, and she was not entirely sure she believed it herself. And yet Mary had to try. Why did the sight of his own face fill him with horror? And these two letters from Moore and Sons, the wholesale chemist and supplier, about some sort of powder he ordered. Look, in the first one they say they're enclosing another batch, and in the second they apologize that it's not working as expected. They offer a refund, but insist that it's identical to the first batch in chemical composition. What if he transformed into Hyde repeatedly, but then the chemical transformation stopped working? What if he became stuck as Hyde and then committed suicide?
But why ever would Dr. Jekyll want to do such a thing? Asked Mrs. Poole.
She sounded completely unconvinced.
I don't know, said Mary. Suddenly she felt very tired. Surely the whole thing was impossible?
No, not impossible. Merely improbable. This was the 19th century, the age of science. Who knew what possibilities existed in the natural world, if a caterpillar could transform into a butterfly? You said yourself that the ways of men are unaccountable. There are many reasons a man, even a gentleman, would assume a disguise. To visit opium dens or prostitutes, commit murder with impunity, do the things that gentlemen are not supposed to do. He may not have been the man we remember.
You've started without me, said Diana.
In comparison to how she had looked earlier, she positively glowed with cleanliness. Her hair was wet and slicked back like a seal's, and she wore a clean white nightdress of Mary's. The cut on her arm was neatly bandaged.
I didn't realize you wanted to read through stacks of documents, said Mary. I don't, but I want to know what you find out.
Diana grabbed a ham sandwich and sat on the other end of the sofa, drawing up her bare feet.
"Put a plate under that," said Mrs. Poole. "You're supposed to call me Miss," said Diana.
"I'll call you Miss when you deserve it," said Mrs. Poole.
"I've put her in the old nursery, Miss," she said to Mary. "I'll brush her clothes for tomorrow, but some of them are in a disreputable state."
"Disreputable yourself!"
Diana shoved the sandwich into her mouth and took a large bite.
"Diana, if you're not polite to Mrs. Poole, your stay in this house won't be a pleasant one," said Mary. "She's the one who cooks for us and cleans our rooms and makes our lives generally comfortable. Although if I don't find a way to make money soon, she'll have to find another employer, and we will have to fend for ourselves."
"I'm not leaving you, miss," said Mrs. Poole. "This has been my home since I was a girl, and I'm staying, whether you can pay me or not."
"I thought you were rich," said Diana. "I wondered why you don't have pictures on the walls and most of the floors are bare. And there are holes in this sofa."
She put her big toe into one.
"Well, I'm not rich," said Mary. "And stop that, or you'll tear it further. When my father died, we discovered that his fortune had disappeared, and my mother's income was only for her lifetime. Now that's gone as well. Even the money she left to pay for your care at St. Mary Magdalene is almost gone.
£23. She had meant to go to the bank this morning after visiting Mr. Holmes, but instead she had ended up in Whitechapel. She would have to go tomorrow, as soon as the bank opened. Once that money runs out, there will be nothing for you or me or Mrs. Poole to live on. I sold everything of value to pay for my mother's care because her income wasn't enough. I've tried to sell this house, but no one will buy it. These are difficult economic times. Not that I expect you to understand, since I doubt you've read a newspaper in your life. And I can't seem to find employment, even as a nursemaid. So there's nothing. I thought if I found Hyde, I could claim the reward. Although if you're correct and my father was Hyde, he died 14 years ago. In the meantime, you will be polite to Mrs. Poole. Of course, if you'd rather sleep in the scullery, you're welcome to do so."
Diana looked at Mary, then at Mrs. Poole, and said, "Thank you for the bath."
She grinned like a monkey, but still they were words Mary had never expected to hear out of her mouth.
"You're welcome," said Mrs. Poole, sounding unconvinced. "Is there anything else you want, miss?"
"No, thank you," said Mary. "But if I do, I'll ring." After Mrs. Poole had left, Mary sat rereading the letter from Italy in silence. Diana chewed on the sandwich with her mouth open. Then,
"What is that?" she asked.
"Aren't you capable of being quiet?" asked Mary.
"Oh, I'm capable, all right," said Diana. "I'll be as quiet as a mouse, for as long as it takes you to notice the seal."
"What do you mean, the seal?" Diana pointed to one of the envelopes lying on the table. It had been sealed with red wax. Impressed in the wax were two letters, S.A. It was the same design as on the watch fob in Molly Keane's hand. For a moment, Mary could not speak. Then,
"How could I have missed that?" she said.
And there it was on another of the envelopes as well. Two envelopes, two identical seals.
"Well, what are the letters about?" asked Diana.
"I have no idea." Mary pulled a letter out of one envelope and handed it to Diana.
"Look."
Diana wrinkled her brow.
"Is it in some kind of code?"
"No, it's in Latin, but I can't read it. Miss Murray started me on Latin, but after my mother became so sick, I couldn't afford a governess. All I remember is Carthago delenda est. They're both in Latin and postmarked from Budapest. Who would be writing to my father from Budapest in Latin? The other letters are the two from Moores about some chemical he was trying to buy. And this one from Italy, which is in English, thank goodness."
"Well, what does that one say?"
asked Diana. Mary gave her a look, sighed, and started reading it out loud.
"My dear Jekyll, I am glad to hear that your experiments are going well. I remain convinced that we are working along the correct lines. The important scientific advances of this century will be in the biological sciences, as the important advances of the previous century